Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated October 24th, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's cover article, He Wants to Be All Over You. Valencell founder Steve LaBeouf is working to place the Raleigh company's sensors in dozens of wearable technology products. This week's lead article is by Lauren Onisorge, and it's entitled Sensory Battle for Your Bodies. They're the odd couple of wearable technology, the scientist, Steve LaBeouf, an NC State University grad with a slight New Orleans drawl, and the executive, Michael Daring, polished and handshake-ready. Together, they're trying to make a dent in the wearable technology industry. LaBeouf has been picking at for years, well before the Twitterati had ever heard the name Apple Watch. With proprietary biometric sensors dubbed Perform Tech, the pair's company, Valencell, is partnering with firms such as Scotia and LG Electronics to get its technology in your ears and on your arms. The potential for payout is there. BCC Research estimates 37% of online U.S. consumers expect to purchase fitness technology in the next 12 months. Research firm IDTechX predicts a $70 billion wearable market by 2024, but other statistics show it won't be an easy road to the payout. Almost one-third of Americans owning a wearable device will stop using it in the first 6 months, according to recent research from Endeavor Partners. Half of American adults who own fitness trackers, including Valencell-fueled products by iRiver and LG Electronics, have already stopped using them, the reports read. LaBeouf, the 40-year-old company president, founded Raleigh-based Valencell with a GE colleague, Jesse Tucker, in 2006, years before the hype. In 2014, the 63-year-old Daring was recruited to the executive team, bringing a history of exits and the administrative know-how to turn LaBeouf's scientific superpowers into cash. They plan to hedge their bets, applying the sensors to various verticals in an attempt to capture whatever wearable technology ends up winning out, whether it's a consumer device or a healthcare tool. At least that's the plan. For the first time, Valencell has a licensing portfolio it can talk about, with public partners such as Jabra, Scotia, LG, SMS Audio, iRiver, and Intel. For the first time, LaBeouf has time to focus on the science, leaving the strategizing to Daring. But as the business starts the shift from upstart to revenue-posting firm, the stakes get higher. Now, with an investment of $16 million from grants and venture capital, a 25-man operation, and early-stage revenue, the company is treading carefully, and it's because the industry is fluid, and Valencell has a lot to lose. If you stop by Valencell's new North Raleigh office, it's likely that you won't find LaBeouf. He's traveling, or tinkering in a back room. There are lots of places to hide at Valencell. Many of its secrets are tucked away in a gym-like lab. 50 non-disclosure agreements with customers mean a lot of code names written on the whiteboards near the treadmill. Perform Tech is already implemented in headphones developed by partners such as LG Electronics and iRiver, but more is coming, as evidenced by the research pipeline written on the walls. Daring and LaBeouf won't be specific about the video game company they're courting, or whether a recent Skullcandy event LaBeouf attended meant a deal. They won't say whether they've spoken with Apple, Google, Sony, or Samsung. Non-disclosure agreements prevent him from specifics, but Daring does say that of the 50-plus companies Valencell is currently working with, more than one will result in a consumer product by Christmas. Not even the 100-plus exercise volunteers know what they're really wearing. He will say that the research is across the spectrum. While the product names vary, wearables really come down to the three categories, says Dan Ledger, principal at Massachusetts consulting firm Endeavor Partners: fitness trackers, healthcare monitors, and activity trackers. Fitness trackers represent Valencell's current licensing revenue, as well as what's dominating the market. They're designed to be worn during a workout and then taken off. But Valencell's plan is to move across the spectrum into two other categories. Those tools can be designed for the 24/7 user to encourage lifestyle change for people wanting to lose weight or increase their productivity, but most people using them aren't part of the population they're designed for. If you're a 25-year-old who runs 3 or 4 days a week, you don't need the help, he says. It's like taking an aspirin when you don't have a headache. The novelty wears off and the device can end up in a drawer. With a 24/7 wearable commitment, further challenges exist. You're trying to build a product that's delivering value, that's really robust, that can withstand the trials and tribulations of living on someone's wrist every day, and it also looks nice, Ledger says. That's a lot. But those aren't details for LaBeouf and Daring. While his team develops the sensors and researches ways for the technology to solve problems for its licensees, the products themselves are outside of Valencell's scope. We are just the ingredient factory, says LaBeouf. Now, but that in itself could mean challenges, says Ledger. Valencell's background is technology, not necessarily each of the verticals it's trying to hit. Ledger uses a call center as an example. A fictitious business exploring how to measure stress levels in its telemarketers so a supervisor could swap out an employee that's getting frustrated. You really need to know a lot about what's happening in a call center, human physiology, about stress. It's not, hey, let's put a few algorithms in here. Oftentimes, there's a big bridge you have to get over where your product works with what of a lot of physiologies. While Valencell tests its prototypes with more than 100 locals in that North Raleigh lab, it may take an even broader population to answer the question a licensee wants to ask, Ledger theorizes. What's to stop the call center from developing its own solution? It's not something LaBeouf worries about. We have an incredibly strong patent portfolio, he says. Valencell does have one big thing going for it, regardless of how many consumers shelve wearables. That's the reason behind its push in the healthcare market. LaBeouf says that that's the immediate goal, to focus on what it does well, accuracy. And the healthcare space, everything from hospital devices to technologies that can help physicians monitor patients outside the hospital walls, is all about accuracy. The healthcare space, it's been around for decades, Ledger says. It's alive and well. It's growing. LaBeouf says this stage in the game is 8 years in the making. While headlines tell him the stakes are high now, he'd argue that they've been high for 8 years. Prior to Valencell, LaBeouf ran a laboratory at GE. He started in solid-state physics research, the same area he worked on at NC State. Soon he was working sensor systems, technologies that were years out, some of which still hadn't seen store shelves. But it wasn't enough to satisfy LaBeouf. The way outside-of-the-box projects were what excited him, not the corporate bureaucracy. In September 2006, he started Valencell. The eureka moment was when LaBeouf and team figured out that they could measure everything that's important off a person in one spot, the ear. So his team filed foundational patents and got to work. Josh Duffy, engineering manager for Scotia Industries, came across Valencell at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas in 2011. Tomas Goldman, vice president of technology management at Jabra, learned about Valencell at the same show in 2012. For our market reasons, we're really invested in developing armbands, Duffy says, so we spoke with Valencell on what it would take to adapt their ear technology to a forearm or tricep-based solution. 6 months after the first meeting, they had a licensing contract, and 16 months after that, a Valencell-fueled armband was in production. When Goldman met LaBeouf, there were only 3 companies creating biometric sensors that could work with Jabra's game plan. Goldman says, adding that the partnership continues, though he can't be specific about what's next. While the real work for Scotia and Jabra begins when the product hits the shelves, for Valencell, the job is in the lab. Valencell doesn't have to worry about market pressures or what color the armband should be. It has to worry about one thing, sensors. Down a hallway in a lab lined with microscopes and electrical wires is where the process starts and where sensors are developed to fit a licensee's needs. Every time a change is made, we track the changes, says Chris Eichbach, the company's in-house exercise physiologist. Each week, between 30 and 40 people stay for an hour in the lab where, for an Amazon gift card, they use the technology during a workout, providing detailed feedback for the licensee. Accuracy is the priority, Eichbach says. And while all agree that's vital in the healthcare industry, Valenzuela's level of accuracy can mean pricier products than what LaBeouf characterizes as more lifestyle-oriented, such as the Samsung Gear Fit. Take iRiver's Valenzuela-fueled headphones, which cost $199. LaBeouf and Deering say wearables across all categories are inching towards Valenzuela's accuracy sweet spot. LaBeouf puts the Apple Watch and Jaybird Rain in the middle, shifting away from lifestyle and towards Valenzuela. The market is coming our way, Deering says. People want to know more than how many steps they take. Technology is moving into things you are already doing on a daily basis. Instead of us trying to adapt to the technology is adapting to how we perform tasks. Jonathan Collins, an analyst at ABI Research, says Deering is right, but that the healthcare applications Valenzuela is stressing will continue to lag consumer shipments for products like iWatches. The total wearable wireless device market will reach almost 200 million devices shipping in 2019, up from less than 60 million this year. But by 2019, healthcare will remain just a portion of that, going from less than 10% of devices this year to just under 30%. LaBeouf knows and acknowledges cheaper devices will always have their fans, but they'll never make that regulated healthcare vertical, he says. Investors, having already dropped more than $13 million on Valenzuela, are bullish about the future. James Pastoriza of TDF Ventures was among Valenzuela's early backers, connected to Valenzuela by another investor acquaintance. Valenzuela's varied verticals as well as its licensing model were what attracted his cash. We can get a lot done and make it more attractive business model by not having to go build devices or wristbands or that kind of stuff, he says. Other investors include True Ventures, Best Buy Capital, and Wall Street Journal Joshua Fund. So far, fitness and healthcare products are Valenzuela's sweet spot, but on other mystery applications are in the mix as LaBeouf and his team hedge their bets with new verticals. Think a first-person shooter game where your accuracy improves as you calm down, or a military field device that can alert medics as soon as there's a problem. But LaBeouf and Deering say those verticals are just the straightest lines for the sensors. They see a future with earplugs that track what temperature helps you fall asleep, telling your smart thermometer to change its settings. They see armbands that can notify you and your doctors before you have a stroke, and they say people will be willing to pay for it. The future is closer than you think, says industry watcher and Validic CEO Ryan Becklin. Durham-based Validic is another ingredient player in this space. Instead of creating sensors, Validic, which partners with firms such as Gartner, develops the infrastructure to move the data from the wearable to the smart device. He's already seen wearable technology's ability to move healthcare outside the walls of a hospital. What happens in between the times that you go to the doctor? The medical provider has no concept of what you're doing, he says. Until now. We have this shift of hospital care moving outside of the hospital, and at the same time we have this explosion of technology, he says. What we have now, it's exciting, it's interesting, it's great, but man, the things that are going to be happening in 5 years, the shift is so fundamentally big, it's hard even for me to really get my mind wrapped around what the ramifications will be. That's the fun, says LaBeouf. The research, seeing how far the sensors will take him, it's what got him out of the GE lab, and for now, what keeps him at Valenzuela. What follows next are estimates of size of wearables industry that vary by research firms. ID TechX is $70 billion by 2024. Juniper Research is $19 billion by 2018. Markets and Market, Market and Markets, $11.61 billion by 2020. Transparency Market Research, $5.8 billion by 2018. And Gartner, by spending $5 billion by 2016. Here's a side article on where are the wearables headed. The most familiar wearable technology is in consumer products, but other applications are in growth mode as well. While slower to take hold than the consumer sector, the healthcare sector is full of possibilities that could have longer-term staying power. This source comes from the Fortune magazine. Currently, $57 million is being spent on activity trackers, $34 million on healthcare, $25 million on smartwatches, $16 million is being spent on wearable cameras, and $11 million are being spent on smart glasses. The market breakdown is $200 million is the projected market for wearable wireless devices in healthcare and consumer in the mobile health market in 2019, 30% of which are the healthcare devices, and $60 million, the total market in 2014, less than 10% representing healthcare devices. As of today's date, Valentel's publicly licensed devices are the iRiver On, a set of headsets where at the price of $199, another set of headphones, which is the Jabra Sport Pulse at $199, LG Heart Rate Earphones, $179, and the Rhythm Smart Wearable Wristband at $99. Currently, Valencel is licensed to measure today heart rate, calories and distance, VO2 max, speed, pace, cadence, and performance tracking. What comes next is R&R interval, heart rate variability, respiration rate, recovery time, and resting metabolic rate. And what's in the pipeline for Valencel? Core body temperature, stress analysis, metabolic analysis, fitness analysis, blood pressure, blood oxygen, triage tools, therapeutic tools, and cardiac output. This week, the managing editor of the Triangle Business Journal, Rebecca Troyer, brings us an article entitled, Trust Atlantic Had Multiple Suitors. Combined Bank Will Have 5 Raleigh Branches. The acquisition of Raleigh's Trust Atlantic Bank by First Tennessee-owned First Horizon National Corporation, a deal worth about $80 million, will create the 11th largest bank in Raleigh. The combined bank will have 5 Raleigh branches, 2% of the local market, and $467 million in local deposits. It's a final chapter in a Raleigh story that started in 2006 when Jim Beck, currently Trust Atlantic CEO and a former Capital Bank CEO, partnered with local investor Steve Johnson to acquire and recapitalize Millennia Community Bank out of Greenville and create the new entity. The deal, valued at $17 per Trust Atlantic share, is 1.61 times Trust Atlantic's tangible book value per share as of September 30th. Beck will become First Tennessee's Triangle Market President, managing commercial banking and branch operations. Ken Reese, First Tennessee's current Raleigh market leader, will assume an expanded role managing private banking and wealth management in the region. For Beck, it's a milestone in a process that began last November. We really started at the board level, a process of thinking about strategic opportunities that the company had. Those opportunities narrowed to the winner, partnering with a larger institution, but First Tennessee wasn't Trust Atlantic's only suitor. I don't want to specify a particular number. I would just tell you there was a very broad and high-level interest in our market, Beck says. It's a dynamic market we're in, and pretty much most healthy financial institutions that aren't here want to be here. We're a very healthy and attractive company. This week's column by Amanda Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. Her first article is entitled The Flipping Point. Two major commercial properties hit the market. For sale, Lenovo's new RTP campus got $130 plus million. The former Sony Ericsson Headquarters Campus on Development Drive in Research Triangle Park is back on the block again, less than 9 months after the buildings were sold for $26 million to a Philadelphia real estate investor. But this time, instead of empty buildings, the campus has the multinational, multi-billion dollar technology company, Lenovo, as its anchor tenant, occupying the entire 486,000 square foot building footprint. Real estate analysts expect there to be multiple competitive bids from real estate investment groups from all around the world to buy the buildings. The site could fetch a sale price of more than $130 million. That would mean Philadelphia-based Rubenstein Partners could gross more than $100 million in less than 1 year from its $26 million investment. The buildings are expected to be sold before the year end. And vacant Solial Center Tower site near Crabtree is listed for sale at $7.5 million. A private equity group that bailed out the troubled Solial Center site near Crabtree Valley Mall when it went into foreclosure in 2011 is putting the land back on the market for sale. The asking price for the 4.9-acre site is $7.5 million. Rialto Capital of Miami had paid $4.2 million for the land at a foreclosure auction, and the investors are banking on the land having increased in value during the economic recovery. The former hotel property had originally sold for $5.7 million in 2003 to a group of local developers led by real estate and hotel investors Sanjay Mudra and Dicky Walia, who were proposing a plan to build a 42-story glass tower that would have a luxury Westin brand hotel along with 54 condominium units on the upper level. The site already has much of the foundation work completed to support the building. However, all construction work and hopes for the building halted in the fall of 2008 when the developer's financing options ran dry near the start of the economic downturn. What else is happening in retail and restaurants? G. Patel's newest restaurant concept, Ferry, opens at Cameron Village. Ferry, the newest restaurant concept by Raleigh restaurateur G. Patel, has opened at Cameron Village in Raleigh. Ferry, which is being described as a new American steak and seafood restaurant, is one of the anchor retail tenants for the ground floor of the new Crescent Cameron Village apartment building, located at the northeast corner of the intersection of Oberlin Road and Clark Avenue. Also, Victorian Rose Bridles changing name and leaving Cameron Village. The owner of Victorian Rose Bridles at Cameron Village has found a new home for her bridal gown shop in a different part of Raleigh and will also be changing the name of the salon. The new name for the store will be La Belle Marie, which is French for the beautiful bride. The new store will be at 6701 Glenwood Avenue within the Haverty Square Shopping Center near the Glenwood Avenue intersection with Duralee Road. And New Harris Teeter opens in the old Galaxy Cinema space on October 29th. Construction is wrapping up at the newly redeveloped Village Square Shopping Center in Cary, with the new Harris Teeter grocery store expected to open by October 29th. The Harris Teeter store will be relocating from a space near Cary Town Center Mall into a new 53,000 square foot space at Village Square. Village Square was previously known as the home to foreign film favorite Galaxy Cinema, but the theater had to be torn down to make way for the new grocery store building. It is located at 885 Walnut Street in Cary, near the intersection of Carytown Boulevard and Maynard Road. Next up, Jason DeBruin's column on healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. Blue Cross Blue Shield says, we have not seen a tremendous exodus. 4 years into the Affordable Care Act, the insurance market has not seen a major shift away from employer-based coverage as some had imagined. So far, we have not seen a tremendous exodus, or even a small exodus, says Barbara Morales-Burke, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina Vice President of Health Policy, speaking October 16th at a State of Healthcare roundtable hosted by law firm William Mullins. Companies still use benefits, and specifically health benefits, as a way to attract and retain top talent and the employer-based model affords companies a good way of achieving just that. Employer-sponsored health insurance covers 149 million people, or some 56% of the U.S. non-elderly population, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. Stephen King, general counsel of the North Carolina Medical Society, points out that it's more of a tax question than anything. Because an employee may buy health insurance on a pre-tax basis, employees would need exponentially higher salaries to afford a similar health insurance plan on an individual basis. I just don't see that happening, says Kane. However, a new trend could see those employers work with private exchanges to offer benefits to employees. A private exchange operates between the employee and the employer and will contract with or create its own set of health plans. It acts much like the state or federally run exchanges do, though without subsidies, in that they connect workers with health plans. These private exchanges are usually built as a technology platform and serve as a portal for individuals to shop for health insurance plans. Importantly for employers, exchanges offer a way to become ACA compliant so they don't have to face the $2,000 per employee penalty and can still offer employer-sponsored health benefits. The Kaiser Family Foundation reports there appears to be a great deal of interest from employers in private exchanges, particularly the largest firms which employ a great share of the workforce. Morales Burke says she has already seen increased interest from employers in the private exchange marketplace, something that might only increase as the employer mandate comes online next year. Kaiser estimates the current private exchange market of at least 2.5 million people, including 1.7 million group plan enrollees. Projections see that increasing to nearly 40 million by 2018, according to Kaiser. The report also found that 13% of employers with 200 or more workers who currently do not offer benefits through an exchange would consider doing so, according to the report. Also, NCSU's Lomax to move into private nonprofit sector. Terry Lomax, who has worked at NC State University since 2006 and most recently as the Vice Chancellor for Research, Innovation, and Economic Development, will move to research group RTI International as Executive Vice President of Discovery Science Technology. She starts in December. While at NC State, Lomax helped professors and students take ideas from a conceptual stage through some funding stages and ultimately to company formation and spin-out, partly through the NCSU Office of Technology Transfer, which falls under her purview. The office has helped bring more than 100 NCSU startups bring 400 products to the marketplace. Combined, these companies have raised $1.6 billion and have a cumulative market cap of $6.2 billion, according to the office. Also, Chimerix is to test Ebola treatment. Durham drug developer Chimerix, helmed by Dr. Michelle Berry, will begin testing its lead drug candidate in patients confirmed to have the Ebola virus disease. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration awarded Chimerix an investigational new drug application on the drug Bricindofovir and authorized testing the drug in Ebola patients immediately. Although Bricindofovir has received recent attention as a potential Ebola treatment, Chimerix has held high hopes for the drug much longer. In earlier lab tests, Chimerix says the experimental drug has shown activity against all five families of DNA viruses. The drug has been tested in more than 1,000 patients. From company inception through June 30th, Chimerix has incurred $170 million in research and development expenses, of which $138 million relates to development of Bricindofovir. Next up, Dawn Wallace. Dawn covers small business personalities and triangle trends. She reports this week that the Sears store at Cary Town Center is closing, with cutting 66 jobs. Mid-January, Sears at Cary Town Center will close its doors. According to Sears Holding Director of Corporate Communications, Howard Reefs, the closure is part of an effort to cut the cost and adjust our asset base and accelerate the transformation of our business model. The 92,000-square-foot anchor store carries appliances, tools, clothing, and it opened in 1991. Reef says liquidation will begin October 31st, and the company hopes to hold on to existing customers through investments in Shop Your Way and integrated retail that will enable the company to engage shoppers through alternate online channels. Some of the store's 66 employees will be eligible to receive a severance package and will have the opportunity to apply for open positions at other Sears or Kmart stores. The company says no other local stores are impacted. In the past year and a half, Sears has closed nearly 100 stores across the country. Analysts say the company is suffering from a lack of investment in its stores compared to the competitors such as the Home Depot, Walmart, and Target. CB&L and Associates Properties Incorporated, which owns Cary Town Center, has not released what the new tenant might be. Dan Summerlin, Director of Corporate Communications at CBL, says, obviously it is too early to announce any plans. However, CBL constantly evaluates and looks for opportunities to enhance our properties for the retail mix. And Dawn would like to report that the DPAC does it again. The Durham Performing Arts Center last year had its second highest season attendance since opening. There were 76 sellout performances, 380,000 in attendance, $23.1 million of a current operating budget, a guaranteed generated net income of $3.9 million, and $1.6 million of that will go to the city of Durham. You should know that Raleigh's Union Station has snagged $1.5 million. A $1.5 million Federal Railroad Administration grant for the Raleigh Union Station project will include a heated concourse in the first phase. Secured in the fifth round of the Transportation Investment Generating Economic Recovery grants from the U.S. Department of Transportation in 2013, the grant will bring the total project funding up to $67.75 million. The project will relocate passenger rail service from the existing Amtrak station on Cabarrus Street to the Dillon Supply Warehouse building at 510 West Martin Street in Raleigh. The transit station will eventually feature connections for Capital Area Transit Bus Service, Long Distance Bus Service, Amtrak, Commuter Rail, and Light Rail, and facilities for taxis, bicyclists, and pedestrians. The grant increase allows for the construction of additional program elements during the first phase of implementation and includes improvements associated with the concourse and the building interior, says Roberta Fox, Assistant Planning and Design Manager of the Raleigh Urban Design Center. Without the funds, the elements could have needed to be constructed at a later phase. The additional funds allow the walkway to be an enclosed passenger concourse with the inclusion of heating and cooling, she explains, and adds that the additional funds also create the chance to have a warm-lit, leasable space for retail and restaurant tenants on the main level by providing them with lighting, heating, and cooling. The project received $15 million in September 2013 from the North Carolina Department of Transportation and received pre-construction approval in April. And in Dawn Wallace's column, she said it. RDU is not responsible for screening since we are not a major international gateway. If someone were to arrive at RDU with symptoms, we would contact Wake County Health and Human Services, who would take the lead. This quote comes from Mindy Hamblin, Raleigh-Durham International Airport Communications Director, on whether RDU will perform additional screening in wake of the Ebola outbreak. This week's Lauren Onisorge's column, which covers technology and entrepreneurship, features a futuristic Raleigh Transit. NCSU design transportation system could brand the city. Imagine brightly colored personal rapid transit vehicles, also known as PRTs, roller coasting around Raleigh, connecting you from Centennial Campus to downtown in minutes. If all goes to plan, the technology could debut in Raleigh in as little as 2 years. The EcoPRT is an innovation being developed on the NC State Centennial's campus. The test vehicle is a metal frame with an engine and wheels. It sits on a tiled floor in front of its prototype, a painted wooden box the size of a Ferris wheel cab. In a quiet lab in Engineering 3 on Centennial Campus, How Stuff Works creator Marshall Breen and assistant professor and entrepreneur in resident Seth Holler have assembled a team of undergraduates for welding and theorizing. Breen sees the project as more than a transportation system. He sees it branding Raleigh, similarly to how the Arch brands St. Louis. There isn't any one thing about Raleigh that makes it cool and interesting, he says. We have a lot of great stuff to visit. It's just spread out. To implement the prototype, a transit line that would connect the James B. Hunt Jr. and DHL libraries at NC State, they'll need $2 million. If the researchers receive funding, NC State would need to approve its implementation. As the car and load would weigh about 1,000 pounds, weight requirements of the track and cost would be far less than what it takes to support a 100,000-pound light rail train. Also, the cars wouldn't stop at each station, just where you're trying to go, zipping off the main line so as not to jam up cars behind them. Light rail trains require a 100-foot turning radius. The small size of the car would make that radius requirement much smaller. The cars can also run on the ground, Holland says, and they wouldn't need much station space, meaning accommodations could be retrofitted into pre-existing shopping centers such as Cameron Village and North Hills, which are both on Brian and Holler's post-NC State implementation list. To start, the cars would probably run at top speeds of about 35 miles an hour, but there's no reason that, with the right funding, they couldn't go 60 miles an hour plus. We also have a spotlight on IBM this week. Ginni Rometty, the IBM CEO, was speaking about earnings result that she admitted were disappointing, and the revenue was down 4% to $22.4 billion. She's quoted as saying, "Our company is fundamentally better positioned than it was a few years ago." Also speaking of IBM is Mr. Martin Schroeder. He's quoted as saying, "Reduction in overall headcount also allows us now to think about how we simplify our business." Mr. Schroeder is the CFO answering a question about IBM's workforce restructuring. IBM also announced it was shedding its chip business, offloading it to GlobalFoundries, paying $1.5 billion. It's the latest in three recent offloads aimed at allowing IBM more leeway to focus on its big data, cloud, and mobile technologies. Here's what IBM has gotten rid of so far this year and who snapped them up. The chip business was shedded and GlobalFoundries picked it up. Low-end server business was shedded and Lenovo picked that up. And finally, the consumer care outsourcing unit was released and it was picked up by Cinex. This week's Triangle Business Journal executive voice is Mr. Scott Harmon. This column is entitled, "Going Where Big Firms Won't Fit. Downtown Durham Developer Chooses the Quirky Sites." This interview was conducted by Amanda Jones Hoyle. Scott Harmon came to Durham seeking an escape from the big, mean city after 19 years living in Houston. Harmon and his business partner, David Arneson, founded Center Studio Architecture in Durham in 2004. 2 years later, they started Revamp Durham, a development firm that's been part of a multiple creative infill and redevelopment projects in downtown Durham over the last few years. Their projects include the three-story Magnum 506 retail and the residential building and the five-story Church and Main condo project. TBJ, you grew up in Texas, but you've sort of become a permanent fixture in downtown Durham. What's kept you here? Mr. Harmon, I've always been more impressed by integrity and authenticity than by status and privilege. Durham is an open source community, embracing anyone that's willing to spend time and energy trying to leave things better than they found it. TBJ, how did Center Studio Architecture get started? Mr. Harmon, I've been working on my own, and when I got extra busy, I would contract out work to David Arneson, who worked at a firm in Chapel Hill. We really enjoyed working together because our talents are so different. I'm a conceptual, big-picture person, and he's brilliant at the details. So I got busy When I got so busy that I needed to hire someone, I offered him the position. He counteroffered and said he'd be interested in a partnership. To this day, David and I are amazed at how comfortable we are working together. TBJ, explain how and why you started your real estate development firm, Revamp. Mr. Harmon, this was always our vision, to create projects ourselves and thereby get to design the kind of projects we wanted to design. My first foray into development was with some property I owned and lived on in Southwest Durham, which I sold to my development mentor, Roland Gammon. It was really important for me to find a way to make the rezoning process less adversarial, and we did that. That project is Windsor Commons and is still being completed today. TBJ, your redevelopment of your current office building at Five Points has won awards for its innovation and revitalization of that part of downtown Durham. How long have you been watching that property, waiting for the right opportunity? Mr. Harmon, our offices were across the street in Julie Stalen's Five Points Loan Company building, right next to Bayou Cafe. We were there for over 5 years and looked across the street daily at the abused and ignored city-owned buildings at Five Points. I remember talking to Alan Delisle, who ran the OEWD department for years, and how ludicrous it was for the city to hold on to these buildings as a possible tear-down and expansion of the lovely, not, Durham Convention Center. Many years later, the city issued an RFP for development proposals. You could write an entire article about the deal for that project, how we got it approved in the middle of the downturn, how we funded our equity to buy our building, and how we created opportunity for other independent business owners to own their own spaces in downtown. TBJ, how are things coming along for your condo project, Church Plus Main? Mr. Harmon, very well. It's a tight, fussy site, which is challenging. It's the first infill construction project inside the downtown loop in 26 years. It's like the city and the contractors and, to be fair, the architects had to relearn how you build in a zero lot line urban environment with no adjacent property on which to stage your construction. But the project is popular and all but two residences are under contract. We love the quirky, hard-to-solve sites that larger national developers aren't interested in. That will be our niche. TBJ, how has your job and career changed in the past 5 years? Mr. Harmon, with the exception of the Jack Tar redevelopment project for Austin Lawrence Partners, I spend about 90% of my time working on real estate development, and David spends 90% of his time on architecture. We each own 50% of both companies. I'm also more involved on the inside of Durham institutions. I started out as an annoying but needed revolutionary, throwing tomatoes at the establishment who were not always thinking creatively enough or trusting in Durham's ability to go beyond the typical Renaissance strategies of downtown. Now I work on those same goals, but as a board member or experienced professional or engaged stakeholder and participant in the process. My goals haven't changed, but my strategies for achieving them are more effective now. TBJ, what is your favorite building, design-wise, in the world? Mr. Harmon, wow. Would have to be Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water. That was the one that inspired me as a teenager to become an architect. It still wins. TBJ, what are your hobbies? Mr. Harmon, I sing second bass in the Duke Chapel Choir. I play contract bridge, the card game. And I'm addicted to CrossFit, and I just started flying lessons. This week's Viewpoint page has two articles. One is the editor's notebook. This column is written by Sukerta Mukherjee, who is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. It is entitled, Want European Flights? Start Buying Some Seats. Raleigh-Durham International Airport is pushing for nonstop flights to Frankfurt, Germany, or Paris, France, within the next 2 years. Air carriers such as Delta and U.S. Airways are running the numbers to see if adding an additional nonstop international flight from RDU makes financial sense to them. As I see it, there are two fronts to this issue. One is a community impact, essentially the economic impact of an area of having another international flight. The other, which is far more important, is the profitability or the yield factor for the airlines. Michael Walden, an NC State University economics economist, was recently asked by airport officials to conduct a study on the impact of adding a flight to Germany or France. His conclusion is as follows. In the first year, the flight will add 100 jobs and save Triangle travelers between $50 million and $100 million in travel time and ticket costs. Two, both international flights would increase access to more than 40 markets in Europe, the Middle East, and the Near East. Three, the Triangle's economic activity will get a $57 million boost by the fifth year and almost $900 million in 20 years. Even if we take the numbers in this study at face value, the yield specialists of these airline companies are running their own sets of numbers to determine whether the routes can be profitable. For the routes to make money, seats have to be filled. For the seats to be filled, companies need to commit and assure that commerce is a central point of this addition. When American Airlines launched its nonstop London flight some 20 years ago, companies such as Glaxo and Quintiles saw the benefit and invested in the flight by channeling their employees to occupy those seats. Whether it's U.S. Airways, Delta, or another airline, these air carriers would want the same for a Frankfurt or Paris route. So, which local companies can commit seats and partnerships that will ensure these flights will move people from the U.S. to Europe? This, I believe, is the critical element of the business model. RDU is trying everything to lure this nonstop service. It has agreed to fork over $2.1 million in incentives that include marketing help, landing fee waivers, and rental discounts. Now they need the government and businesses to join and sweeten that pot. Make no mistake, this is no different from recruiting a new company to our area that promises to create jobs. In this case, however, another nonstop service to Europe will benefit the entire region and bolster our community brand. This week's guest column is Elaine Kamark. She is a co-chair of Reforming America's Tax Equitability Coalition that represents almost 900,000 members, companies, jobs in North Carolina. Her column is entitled, In Dire Need of Corporate Tax Reform. Businesses in Raleigh-Durham are among the most successful in the country because they constantly search for innovations and efficiencies that will allow them to outperform their competitors. Such companies rely on a free market economy that will support their investments and allow them to grow. However, because of our outdated tax code, today's business environment is not equipped to foster rapid or sustainable growth. Without comprehensive reform, our current code is stifling the development of businesses in North Carolina, jeopardizing the U.S. economy and forcing businesses in North Carolina and throughout the nation to face a competitive disadvantage compared to foreign rivals. North Carolina businesses are being heavily taxed by the federal government's out-of-date tax code that requires American companies to pay one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world, at 39.1%. Foreign competitors are lowering their rates and giving American-born companies an incentive to move abroad. To protect North Carolinians' jobs, the federal government must pass comprehensive tax reform. During a recent tax reform panel discussion at Campbell University, Bill Brown, owner of Brown & Wood Incorporated of Greenville, made a passionate plea for a simpler tax code. Reducing the burden on businesses by updating our outdated tax code would empower companies to continue to invest in America's economy. Brown, the former chairman of the North Carolina Forum for Research and Economic Education, pointed to reducing rates and simplifying our code as a way of boosting business growth. American businesses need a tax structure that supports job creation and is adaptable to 21st century economy. As demonstrated during the engaging discussion at Campbell, comprehensive tax reform is necessary and is an important issue for the North Carolina business community. Regardless of size, American businesses stand to gain from comprehensive reform. It is a myth that corporate taxes only affect large American businesses. A recent U.S. Chamber of Commerce poll reiterated the importance of tax reform to North Carolinians. According to the poll, the state's residents overwhelmingly support cooperation between Congress and the President on tax reform. 70% of residents surveyed support cooperative reform aimed at creating a fairer tax code. A lower corporate tax rate would improve living standards by spurring investment and employment, as well as increasing government productivity. Strong growth in Raleigh and throughout North Carolina will not last without legislation that simplifies the code and reduces the rate to an internationally competitive level. Corporate tax reform is helping businesses at the state level, but local businesses also need action in Washington if our economy is expected to remain vibrant. State reform efforts send a direct message to Congress that politically driven gridlock should no longer hinder bipartisan-supported reform. North Carolina job creators are doing their part to hire and invest, but that growth is not guaranteed. Tackling tax reform in Washington is imperative to the future success of American businesses and our local and national economy. America needs to win back its competitive advantage, but it cannot do so without reform. On a completely different note, this week's Business Survey Pulse. How concerned are you that Ebola will come to North Carolina? There were 277 responses, and 48% were very concerned that this poses a threat to our safety. 28% were somewhat concerned it could come here, but it's not likely to spread, and 24% were not concerned at all. The tweets of the week are as follows. Learned a lot about Raleigh-Durham today, mainly that they hate it called Raleigh-Durham. This is from at Black Heirlooms. Also, Raleigh drew one of the nicest, most jocular, and patient crowds we've ever had. They set the bar high for the rest of this trip. This was hashtag BGICTOR from Big Gay Ice Cream. And here's the hype for this week. Triangle of North Carolina cities and institutions made headlines in recent national rankings. Number one, Wake County leads the state in animal-related crashes by the North Carolina Department of Transportation. Number three, North Carolina's rank is best for business, tied with Georgia. This comes from Development Counselors International. And number eight, Raleigh Cary Metro's ranking for attracting the most college graduates. This comes from the City Observatory. And number 11, Chapel Hill cited as one of the 11 top cities for music that aren't New York or L.A. And that comes from Mike.com. What was seen and heard this week? Goodnight jokes with the governor at the SAS New Building Celebration. Governor Pat McCrory has seen the ads. You know, the ones highlighting the coal ash controversy. It's a sore spot. At the SAS celebration for the opening of Building Q, SAS CEO Jim Goodnight joked with the governor. "Did you get that coal ash off your hands?" Goodnight asked. "You're not messing up this building, are you?" And Triangle Business Journal asked McCrory what he thought of those coal ash ads. And McCrory said they ought to be spending that money to clean up the environment. On the move this week, BB&Y Cafe and Catering is moving to Briar Creek. BB&Y Cafe and Catering, a Raleigh eatery since the 80s, is leaving its site on National Drive off of Women's Club Drive for the upcoming Triangle Shooting Academy in Briar Creek. Projected to open late spring of 2015, owners Scott Jones and his mother Johnny Jones are looking forward to having more exposure and a closer reach to Research Triangle Park for the catering arm of their business. "We are really looking forward to it," says Scott Jones, who says he anticipates hiring about 10 people. The restaurant was founded by his father, Nicholas, in downtown Raleigh. BB&Y stands for Biscuits, Burgers, and Yogurt, but was shortened when the restaurant moved to Glenwood Place. And we have a feel-good day at the spa for cancer survivors. On October 20th, the Pinehurst Resort hosted its fifth annual Pink in Pinehurst Day, an event that celebrates breast cancer survivors and promotes awareness about the disease. During the event, women were offered either a free massage or facial and the opportunity for a pink polished manicure. After their spa treatments, the women were invited to the resort lobby to write a message on a rock, which they placed inside one of five vessels created by North Carolina artist Monica Staples. About 150 breast cancer survivors and their friends attended this year. You should know that Canes fans are hungry for mobile data during the game. Carolina Hurricanes fans have beat those in Long Island, Philadelphia, and Detroit in wireless engagement. According to a report from AT&T, attendees during the Hurricanes opening night at PNC Arena used 107 gigabytes of data. That's equivalent to more than 305,000 social media posts with photos, a 197% increase in traffic when comparing total data usage to last year's openers. Here's how other arenas used AT&T's venue-specific cellular distributed antenna system, DAS, network fared during their openers. Chicago Blackhawks, more than 154 gigabytes, an 86% increase. Los Angeles Kings, more than 120 gigabytes, 62% increase. Carolina Hurricanes, more than 154 gigabytes, and a 197% increase. The Philadelphia Flyers, more than 101 gigabytes, 75% increase. Florida Panthers, more than 95 gigabytes, 19% increase. The New York Rangers, more than 94 gigabytes at a 294% increase. More than 87 gigabytes, a 55% increase for the San Jose Sharks. The Pittsburgh Penguins had a more than 86 gigabyte demand, a 207% increase. The Washington Capitals used more than 76 gigabytes of data, an 87% increase. And the New York Islanders used more than 76 gigabytes of data for a 68% increase. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at www.triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.